Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to Lydia Tong. Lydia is the veterinary pathologist at Taronga Zoo. If you've ever watched CSI, that's how you should picture Lydia's day job, except with animals instead of humans. Lydia has linked domestic violence and animal abuse, uncovered a greyhound killing scandal, and is now on the road to ending the illegal wildlife trade. I'm really excited to be sitting down with Lydia today on this episode of Talking Australia. Today we're at Taronga Zoo on location with Lydia Tong. Lydia, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, Lydia, you're the vet pathologist here at Taronga. Explain to me what that is.
Yeah, so I'm one of the veterinarians in the hospital, but my area of the specialty is in pathology, which is kind of like being the investigative vet on the team, or a bit like being the zoo coroner is how I often explain it. So my job is to investigate and get to the bottom of any animal deaths, and that might be animals that are animals that live in our zoo, but also can be all of the many wildlife species that come in through our hospital that for rehabilitation. And I'm also there to help with diagnosis of diseases or problems in animals that are, say, in care in the hospital or in the zoo. So if they have an unusual growth or skin disease or anything else that, or maybe a bigger problem in the population, like multiple animals having an issue, that's where I kind of jump in to help kind of tackle solving that problem.
Mm. And I feel like coming from an outsider's perspective, you have one of those jobs that maybe vets sort of dream of. So I'm wondering, before you, you know, went into forensics and pathology and all of that, when was the first time you remember kind of thinking, oh, I want animals to be, you know, my life. I want to spend my life around animals.
Yeah, for me, it was not so much a moment. It was just always part of my existence. So I was born in North New Zealand, in Northland, and grew up on a small farm. Well, my parents weren't farmers, but we had like 15 acres. So I always had a few cattle around and dogs and cats and lambs and all sorts of things, like a bit of a real sort of farmyard existence. And I used to spend a lot of time as a kid on a farm of a couple who were like our aunts and uncles, and I used to go down and like help with the milking and sit and pick bugs off the cows and just weird stuff that that now kind of makes sense now that I'm a vet pathologist, but yeah, no, it's something I think I was born with.
Mm. And at what point did you think, I'm going to take this passion and I'm going to take it to university and, you know, pursue it at a high level?
Yeah, so I started out when I was really little, thought I wanted to be an archaeologist. Like I love digging for treasure.
Oh, and same.
Yeah, so cool, huh? Weird bones, kind of dark stuff, I guess. And then I think maybe a little bit older when I realised I was really kind of loved the biological sciences and, of course, was so drawn to animals. So when I went to vet school, I didn't know this is what I'd end up doing. Like it makes sense now, retrospectively, or with the retrospective scope, as we like to say in the nerdy pathological sciences. But I thought I was going into vet school to be a regular vet, a James Herriot style vet. That's what I saw, I guess. But it was kind of through my vet school career that I realised I was feeling this sort of tug toward what I call the dark side, the path side. Not right at the beginning. I was also having quite a nice time at university, so I wasn't in the first couple of years like always as focused maybe as I could have been, but that kind of pulled together toward my later years, and I realised when we started doing, like I remember vividly doing we had one session where we had did a post-mortem class with horses, and that was really, you know, that's quite
What was visceral. That like?
Very visceral. It sounds, you know, silly. I mean, it is literally and figuratively. But I just, there was something that connected with me with that, in that, not that it was anything about the gore. I mean, it's gory, but for me it was about seeing the kind of truth. Like, that's what I love about pathology, is that you actually get to the bottom of solving these really big problems, problems of what was happening with that animal, or what's happening with animals in a population. So to actually get inside and see it and feel it and have an answer resonated with me a lot. And also, I'm quite a messy person, and pathology, you can get away with being quite messy. So it kind of clicked a bit. But it was after that, I did 6 years of vet school, and so that was like my fourth year. What I managed to then do is I realised I kind of wanted to connect my love for wildlife with the pathology. So I contacted London Zoo and to ask if I could come and just do pathology placement, because they're one of the, and you know, there's not many zoos around the world that have a pathologist, and London Zoo's one of them. So I said, oh, look, I'm really interested in doing a placement, but I'd just like to come and do pathology. And they said, oh, like, we haven't been asked that before. Let us
really?
Get back to you.
Yeah, which I thought that would be really competitive.
Well, so getting into, say, here at Taronga is this case as well, for our vet students have to apply like 3 years in advance to get a placement, just to do the application. And London Zoo, for sure, to go and do one of the routine vet school placements, you know, I would have had to have applied a couple of years before, but I kind of suddenly had this brainwave, and it was about a year in advance, I think. But I to this day, am amazed by that too, that people hadn't thought to specifically ask for a pathology placement. But I'm darn pleased that I did that, because it was quite pivotal for me. I went in and spent time, so they were their pathologist, Ed Flack, and when I was there, very unfortunate, sad for the chimpanzees there, but one of their young male chimpanzees, Zephyr, this is his name, he was a teenager and appeared to be in peak health, but he just dropped dead one day. And so I was very much along with the pathologist, you know, thrown into this incredible experience. I can't explain like what it was like. Well, I just remember it vividly, walking in to the post-mortem room. He happened to be lying on his front. And if you look at there, like the back of a chimp in that context, like it's like a man sitting there, and like their legs are not so human, but just the shape of them, it was quite amazing. And what it turned out when the postmortem was finished was that he had a sudden cardiac death, so sudden death due to heart disease. And his when we looked at the what we call the histology, so the microscopic slides from his heart, I was very much the student at that stage. But when that was looked at, it was shown that he had degenerative changes in his heart muscle. And so for my little project, I think that happened quite early on, so I got given a little project to do when I was there. So I investigated all of the deaths of chimpanzees in the zoo over the last, as far back as I could go, basically, which was a good 50-odd years. London Zoo has, like, amazing, underneath the vet hospital, it's got, like, these cavernous walkways. It's like a basement of dreams for me, because it's sort of like pots of, you know, a dolphin brain, and boxes of old, like just old paperwork, and just like secrets that I they were really happy. They were like, off you go. And I just went down and ferreted around in there, a bit like kind of almost like archaeology, not quite, but kind of like digging around. And then also so it's the Zoological Society of London, and they have this amazing old library where all of their older records are. So I could go quite far back and look at what the previous chimps had died from. And what was really neat was to be able to show, actually, there's been quite a high incidence of heart disease in this family, in the group, and which actually, by the way, is understood now to be quite normal for captive chimps, not wild chimps, but captive chimps do have a higher degree of heart disease. But there was also, when we looked at the family tree, it actually made up a family tree. I've got a sister who's amazing at genealogy, so and at the software. So we made up a family tree and found that Zephyr's half-brother, Wally, I think his name was, had also died of a very similar heart condition a number of years earlier. And then that also their family tree in particular had seemed to have a particularly high kind of incidence of the stuff. And what happens, and we see it too, you know, in any zoo, when you're dealing with cases over a very long time, it can be hard to see those patterns unless someone specifically goes back to look at them. So it was a really rewarding project for me because I could kind of do something a bit useful. You're not used to being that useful as a student. And then after that, we had involved a woman, Professor Mary Shepherd, who's based in London. She's a heart pathologist, so just hearts and just humans. So she knows her game very well. And she re-reviewed and looked at Zephyr's heart and said, right, this is almost exactly like a condition that humans get called ARVC. For anyone who's interested, it's arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. It's a bit of a mouthful. That's a heart condition. So when sports people like drop dead in the, sometimes you're going to get famous footballers or marathon runners and people who are otherwise completely healthy and usually quite young kind of drop dead. That's one of those conditions. And it looked exactly, almost exactly the same in Zephyr. And in humans, it's thought to be multifactorial, but it's definitely got an inherited component. So we think that we're seeing a inherited disease in the chimp family. So really fascinating stuff. And so you can imagine, so that kind of whole investigation and writing up those cases took a year or two, but I was just like, this is sold, like this is my future. I just loved it.
Yes, the investigation kind of just that whole process just ignited that passion immediately.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then when did you come to Australia and when did you kind of start doing those type of veterinary investigations here?
Yeah, so I graduated from vet school in 2009. Gosh, 10 years. and then I worked as a regular vet for like 2 years and or a little bit under. And then I took this six-month trip where I it sounds weird. It was amazing. 6 month trip sailing the Pacific with the US Navy. It's basically the US military preparing for if there's, say, another big tsunami event or other large scale kind of humanitarian disasters where there needs to be a response. So they're kind of training for that. And then what they do is that they engage multiple other military, so Australian Air Force and Army. New Zealand Navy was involved. There were some Canadian Air Force and some Singaporean military. So they're practicing kind of like a multi-national response. And then they also get some NGOs involved, again, because that's kind of the real world. So, and the most of the trip is focused, of course, on human kind of human welfare and around bringing human medical care, so medical, surgical, dental stuff, some construction works. So actually, the Australian Army, so diggers go out and do construction projects alongside them. And then there's a relatively small but, you know, wonderful, obviously, veterinary team. So the American Navy doesn't officially have veterinarians. I do believe that they do have dolphins in the Australian Navy, sort of like undercover dolphins that can detect mines and that sort of thing.
I've read about this. This is insane.
Yeah, but officially, as far as I understand, officially there's not a US Navy veterinary corps.
I'm just trying to take in the fact that you worked as a vet for the US Navy. Like, I'm just now taking that all in.
Yeah, sorry, I was just not that. It was like a very rose-tinted life as a military vet. We did have to get up at like 4 a.m., which for me is not easy. And I slept in like, I was in the enlisted quarters, and it was one of the US Navy's oldest ships we were on. In fact, it was retired, I think, immediately after the trip, but they were bunks like four in a row. So it was really like, you know, the coffin bunks. But it was quite amazing. And actually, what the cool thing, interesting thing about that ship is that up until that point, it had always been a stag ship. So it had only ever had men on it. So we had to come on board as women and be like, hey, guys. And so they had to sort of just make it work with having girls' quarters and things. But we could see the boys down the stairs, like the and up the stairs. And so, you know, it would be like, ooh, and the boys would be downstairs playing their guitars at nine, and the, you know, girls were up the stairs. But it was all, we had to behave very much in a strictly military fashion, you know. And we had in our bunk room, it was a good mixture of Australian, Canadian and American forces and a couple of us NGO types. But we were very much kept in line by the American Army sergeant. So
I can imagine that.
Oh, yeah, you don't, you do not miss. So I had originally planned I would go back to England. So I was practicing in London before I left. I'd originally planned to go back to England, but I didn't have a job to go back to. I'd left my job. And then it was high after many months at sea in the Pacific, in the glorious sunshine and just the space and the, like, just amazing part of the world that it is, I just sort of increasingly realised I couldn't go back to London. I do have a lot of affection for London, but it's not me, I don't think. And and being originally from New Zealand, I also had, by that point, half of my family were in Australia. So I kind of went, you know what, I'm going to look. So I actually applied for my training job as a pathologist, to learn to train up to be a pathologist from the boat, and it was at Sydney University, sort of didn't look back, basically. And it was from that point, so that was 2011. So 2011 is when I arrived in Australia and started my pathology journey.
And I know what you said, you did that groundbreaking research around the link between domestic violence and pets. I was hoping you could kind of go into some of that research.
It started coming back to when I talked about being in the RSPCA shelter as like 11, 12 years old, that my sort of passionate interest in those animals and their stories was kind of started. And then as a student, when I was a vet student in the UK, I decided from my sixth year, my final year project, we had to do just to choose an elective. So you could just go and spend a few weeks in one of the departments and do a bit of a project at uni. But I decided I really wanted to go spend some time at the RSPCA and do a research project looking at what were the pathologies or the features of animals that have been injured by abuse, because that science hasn't really been there. There'd been a couple of, an author called Munro who did a groundbreaking piece of work about 5 or 6 years earlier, who'd looked at who'd asked vets what they had seen in terms of abuse or highly suspected abuse cases in veterinary practice. So we knew it was much more there than people were acknowledging. But there hadn't been any work that had been done that actually looked at, like, what are the ways that you can diagnose abuse, what kind of injuries are highly likely to be abuse injuries and what aren't. Because that work had been done in people in about the 1960s, or had started being done, and here we were in medicine way behind. As a student, I thought, oh, let me see if I can do that. And actually what was really neat in the end and very much supported by RSPCA and actually a Dogs Trust, which is another big welfare organisation in the UK, also supported the research as well. And I was able to go back and find a number of cases. I think it was about 20 cases that I had in the prior 2 years that were in the had gone through the RSPCA hospital that were absolutely confirmed abuse cases and where those animals had sustained fractures. And compared those to all the other fractures that had occurred in dogs. So this is all dogs, occurred in dogs that had come to the hospital in that same time frame, but had had accidents. And then said, what are the ways in which these fractures differ? So how can a vet look at a fracture pattern in a dog and say this correlates with an abuse injury or not? And actually there were a number of ways in which abuse fractures in dogs can raise your index of suspicion as a vet in practice. So having multiple fractures, having fractures on more than one side of the body is highly suspicious for abuse. Having fractures that are old by the time they, from many days to weeks old by the time they eventually get to the vet. Even more so if they have fractures that are of two different ages. So when you x-ray a fracture, you can get a pretty good idea of, not specific, but a good idea of how old that fracture is. And then the shape of the fracture. So fractures that were straight through the bone were more likely to occur in abuse. And that's interesting because that's kind of consistent with a focal blow to the leg, whereas like being hit by a car, which is a common cause of fractures, accidental fracture in animals, they tend to cause much more kind of complex or spirally or what we call diagonal, like oblique fractures. So that was really, that was like hugely rewarding for me. And I remember quite vividly receiving an email or a call from someone who was investigating an abuse case in Boston in the US, not long after that work was published, and saying, oh, we've got this case. I think it was a dog maybe that had been buried and recovered, and there'd been an accusation or a charge of abuse. And they'd used my five indicators, and they'd found that I think 4 out of 5 of them matched, and that was going to be used in that case to actually as a presentation of evidence for that case. And so that was quite meaningful for me to kind of see that it was being used in that way. I mean, it's just always about, and the same in all of my pathology and especially forensic work, it's being about being able to bring more fact and evidence into all of these discussions. What became more evident to me was how animal abuse doesn't occur in a vacuum. We have this kind of, and I had it as well, this understanding of animal abusers as being kind of the, you know, it's the precursor to being a serial murderer. It's these really psychopathic, twisted minds that do these things, and it's a rarity. But the reality is, as I think our whole society is becoming more aware now, is that violence against vulnerable individuals, particularly in homes, is sadly really common. And when I say vulnerable individuals, that might be a violent person's partner or children in their lives, and that extends to animals. And it appears to be often the same perpetrators. So As I became more aware of this, I also became aware that there was not, often in the veterinary world, and in forensics and wildlife too, there's lots of gaps in our research. I mean, it's no surprise in the human medicine side, they've got one species to deal with. We've got, 400,000 or so.
Just a few.
Yeah. And we're coming up behind. Vets only started as a thing in the 18th century, so we've got a bit of catching up to do. The main problem, I think, is that vets are not trained, not given as much training as we could, partly because we don't have enough science yet. We need more of that. But also that we don't have as much built-in protection for vets who are worried about abuse and want to report. My fiancé is a emergency physician for humans, and we call him a human doctor. Mm-hmm. He's human. And so we are quite, we always find it really interesting to compare and contrast our worlds, our professional worlds. And, you know, he talks about when he has cases of, say, children that come in and where doctors might have a suspicion. But what's been done on the human side is that it's all it's mandatory. The reporting is mandatory, but also they have a complete framework, and they're completely protected professionally when they have to go down that route. So all that happens, if you have a child that has, a particular fracture, say, that is considered a bit concerning, for doctors, they go, look, hi, I'm really, apologize, it's required by law. Like, if whenever I see a fracture like this, I just have to ask you these series of questions. I have to do this and that, and you go through it. And that is just the way it is. And for vets, we haven't got that in place, and I hope it will come.
We'll be back with our conversation with Lydia Tong just after this. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We are back with Lydia Tong. And I want to talk about, I guess Australians are known for being obsessed with true crime and everyone knows the lead investigators of these big cases. So I wanted to go into one of your, I guess, bigger cases. I know that after the Greyhound ban was brought in, you were the one of the lead investigators on, you know, finding out whether or not one of the mass graves in the Hunter Valley were, you know, basically how did the greyhounds die? And that had like an immense amount of public pressure and everyone wanting to, you know, and I know that there had been, I guess, previous investigations that, you know, there was lots of misleading information going around. So I guess how do you go into an investigation like that with an immense amount of public pressure?
That particular case, so the final report, just to start at the end, the final report came out about the same week or just after the ban came in. So just as we were about to report, that's when that big political decision was made. So we were kind of working in the year before that as things were hotting up, but certainly we weren't necessarily, that was quite a surprise, I think, to everyone who, well, everyone in the state, that that was not necessarily seen coming. So dealing with that at the end was interesting. I can kind of come back to that. But that case, it's obviously contentious. It was on a property that was an active greyhound industry property, but the people who lived there were, in fact, they were the ones that had originally pushed for the investigation. So that made a big difference because we could work on site with, like, comfortably. But the big things that made a difference for me was the team I worked with. So it was a small team. I was the only sort of veterinary person. The three others were the senior counsel that was running the investigation and two private investigators. The three of them actually had been detectives, trained as detectives in the 70s and so immensely experienced and had so much wisdom. So there I was, you know, coming in, and that was my first big forensic project like this. And they went a long way to kind of really helping guide me with some of those pressures. Like, the position I always take with and have since with pressure in those forensic cases, especially where there's any form of like public awareness before the fact, is just to, you just have to blank it out. Especially for me as the, you know, I'm the sort of the scientific person coming and trying to establish the evidence. And so I have to be, and I, you know, am, and that's always my position, is all I'm interested in is the physical facts about the, you know, what do I find in the ground here, and focus on that. Never being tempted to be involved in any way in any form of media when that stuff's going on, because it can be very, obviously it might be interesting or informative, but ultimately most of these projects are ultimately, the facts come out in the end, and it's better, I find, to let those facts speak for themselves. It was really quite fascinating, and I had to, as I've learned, and as is really important in any kind of forensic work, you have to know what your expertise is and know the limits of that. So I got a team on board that was a forensic anthropologist and a forensic archaeologist. So getting them, being able to get them on board to assist with how you manage a site like that. We had multiple places to dig and to search. We had one place where we knew we had remains, and we had a whole property, like a large, I can't remember how many acres, but probably maybe at least 100. Other places where we could look, and we found more remains. So their expertise was just completely invaluable.
And it's almost like you've done all these, all these different cases that have been more and more large scale, and now your current project at Taronga is probably of the largest scale, which is taking on the illegal wildlife trade. So take me into kind of your work on that here at Taronga.
It's kind of a perfect knitting of kind of my two areas of passion. So working, you know, with wildlife pathology and also on the forensic side. But it certainly wasn't just like, you know, not me alone. It's required in a team from Taronga of a conservation biologist who's really led this project, Phoebe Ma, and our nutritionist, Michelle Shaw, and as well as several other external team members. Taronga's become increasingly involved and passionate about tackling now what is the second greatest, if not in for some species, the greatest threat to species survival, which is the illegal trade. And we became aware of it. In fact, Cam, our CEO, was talking to us about the problem with echidnas being illegally traded out and laundered, what gets called laundered, like money laundering, but wildlife laundering, where you basically fraudulently certify that an animal has been legally bred and then send it overseas illegally. And this gets done with echidna. We know this happens because in Indonesia they have certification, export licenses to export 50 echidna a year as long as they are captive bred, second generation, so that their parents are also captive bred. But we know from international knowledge and records that in 100 years, there's fewer than 50 echidna have ever been successfully bred in captivity to breeding age. They're just incredibly hard. They obviously breed very well in the wild because short-beaked echidnas are doing great and have done. They've been going for 160 million years. They're just amazing.
They're doing
dinosaurs.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. They're, on a side note, echidnas are amazing. Like, they're half reptile, half bird, half mammal. I know that's three halves, but they're just, yeah, they're incredible. Side note. But so we basically became aware of this problem. We thought, oh, and Phoebe Ma and myself and with Michelle, we're sort of having a discussion, like, surely, like, we're in such a unique position here at the zoo, particularly in pathology. Like, we have, I do postmortems on about 1,200 wild species, like non-domestic species a year, of which a proportion is zoo population animals, but lots are external wildlife coming in. Either they're animals that have come in for rehabilitation and sadly don't make it, or even other external wildlife postmortems that I receive. And what a unique situation to have access to animal samples that could be used to help develop testing. You know, we've got animals that come from known backgrounds and unknown backgrounds, and all of the samples we can collect without harming an animal, because they're all, it's all kind of what we call opportunistic samples, so animals that have already died for another reason. Like, we always want to use every single bit of that animal to for some purpose that we can. Like, that's kind of my bit, like they say about the you know, using every part of the mammoth that people used to do. Like, you make sure that you use every single bit. So we just said, surely we can tackle this. And again, like a synergistic thing, Phoebe was at a conference where she heard this bird ecologist speaking called Kate Brandis. She's at UNSW. And she had developed this really neat citizen science project called the Feather Map, where she wanted to know, to try and track where water birds were migrating across Australia by collecting feathers. And what she wanted to be able to do is do a special analysis of the feathers to determine how much of 24 different elements were in the feather, like at different places along that feather. And she had decided to do this using a completely novel method that had never been used on biological samples before. It was a nuclear science tool that had been developed to help basically geologists or miners work out what elements were in a geological core. Like, you drill down, pull out a long kind of core of rock, and then you analyze it. And she said, well, darn it, I'm going to use this on feathers. And she did, and it was working for mapping feathers around Australia. So then in theory, what she could do is you go to one waterhole, scan a feather, and you go, right, this feather matches feathers that have been grown at this other waterhole across the country. So that bird must have grown that feather there, flown to this waterhole, and then dropped it. So really, really clever science. And Phoebe said to her at this conference, oh my gosh, can we talk? Because I've got this idea. Do you think we could use this to try and identify where other animals have grown their feathers or any kind of keratin spikes or scales? Because we want to be able to test where an animal's come from so that we can determine, you know, whether it was captive bred or wild or taken from the wrong national park or all these sorts of things. Just find out where traders are getting their animals from is just like a basic thing that needs to be done to try and tackle the illegal trade. And Kate said, I reckon we can. And sure enough, so we did a study on, like a pilot study on echidna, and especially with that machine learning technique that's a part of the science that goes way over my head, but I'm told by the experts. that, you know, it could predict then. We sort of trained the machine to read the data point. So the scanner would read about two or 300 points down the echidna quill. And at each point it would read where the amount of 24 elements at each of those points. So then we ended up with like 220,000 data points. And the machine could take all that and predict by reading the quill whether that animal had been living wild or whether it had been in captivity. The neat thing about echidnas too, and with a lot of keratin, it depends. Bird feathers are grown in about a week, flight feathers in general. So it's you're getting a snapshot in time. But echidna quills are gradually growing, like our fingernails. So we had an echidna that had only been with us for a couple of years, and we could see the point at which her quill had changed from being a captive quill for a wild quill to a captive quill, which was really cool. So now what we're doing with that, and that got published and works, and so we're now hugely expand that by doing a couple of things. One is that the base thing we think needs to be done is to build a library, a reference library of keratin for lots of, you know, obviously targeting the highly trafficked species so that we can then scan all of those. And
in terms of, just going back, in terms of Australia, what would you consider a highly trafficked species in terms of Australian species?
Probably the biggest problem species for Australian trade at the moment are reptiles. So blue-tongued lizards and the shinglebat lizards are two of the really trafficked animals. And we really sadly here at the zoo, we receive several times a year shipments of reptiles that have been found in the mail. So the border force or the mail exchange find these animals, alive in theory, when they x-ray packages and things, and they pick them up and they're brought in and they're shoved into these tiny holes and in socks and all sorts of dreadful things being sent out of the country. And so we'll rehabilitate the animals where we can. Sometimes they're dead even by the time they get here. And then theoretically going off to Europe or the US or Asia or various places. And the traders don't care because as long as they get a few, you know, these animals, they can nick them from the wild and make a lot of money doing that, even if only a few survive. We've had pregnant ones die and then they give birth. Well, pregnant ones give birth and then their babies never survive when they've given birth after all that stress. So it's pretty awful. So those two species are big ones, but also parrot species are an issue as well. So we're in discussions with and hoping that we're going to be able to support the government in developing some tests for them. So that they can actually use them on the front line. That's the really neat thing about doing science here is that here at Taronga is that because we're not formally an academic institution and we're not for profit, it means that we can focus our science on actual real world like problems and be just wanting to, like, all we really want is to be able to develop that test. We want to develop that reference library and target species. We've got six target species. Plus, as well as the Australian branch, we've also got samples that Phoebe collected over in the island of Palawan in the Philippines with three critically endangered species. So the Philippine pangolin, so pangolin being the most trafficked mammal on Earth, being just decimated by desire for scales in particular. And they're also one of our legacy species for our 10-year. We're committed to helping the conservation of 10 species in particular, and pangolin's one of those. And then also the Philippine cockatoo and the Palawan forest turtle. And what we're really interested in that study is, the Palawan forest turtle, they only live on one island and they only have a few water holes where they're still living. And we think we can actually pinpoint which water hole that they've come from by doing that science. And with the pangolin, no trade of pangolin is legal. So we're not trying to work out if a pangolin scale is legal or not, because they're always illegal. But we think it's going to help us identify where the scales have come from, because sometimes it's just the animals found in bags, but sometimes it's just tons of scales, like tons and tons of scales. It's just mind-boggling. We're really excited about that. And the next phase, so the machines that we've originally done the research on are based out at ANSTO, Australian Science Nuclear Technology Organisation. They're kind of big, you know, you go into the big official labs. But what's really cool is that the science has been miniaturized down to handheld machines. And so what we're, our vision is now that, that we'll be able to have border authorities scanning animals, and it's completely non-destructive. It's completely non-invasive. It wouldn't, you know, I'd scan myself in a second, millions of times, find out where I've been hanging out, scan myself. And yeah, so we could just literally scan, we think, an echidna, a lizard, and immediately that bounces up to our cloud reference library and says this animal is from X or Y or wild or captive caught, captive bred, and they can make an enforcement decision on the spot, or at least have enough information to say, I'm holding up this trade.
Okay, I feel like I could sit here and talk to you for like 400 hours, but I also feel like I'm keeping you from really important work. Oh. So thank you so much for hanging out with me today, Lydia. I really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it. You know, I, as you can tell, I can talk for hours. Talk the hind leg off a donkey and then dissect it. So yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Lydia Tong. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.